the pot, and I became so bored that I began writing scripts backstage in my dressing room for a new BBC radio comedy series produced by Humphrey Barclay called I'm Sorry I'll Read That Again, which starred John Cleese, Bill Oddie, Timbrook Taylor and Graham Garden, the returning alumni from Broadway. One night, engrossed in writing comedy, I noticed that the theatre had fallen silent, and Richard Simpson, the very calm leading actor, was looking over my shoulder.
How's the writing going, Eric?
Oh, fine, thanks. Good, good. Funny? Not bad. Good. Look, I'm sorry to bother you, but would you mind joining me on stage? Shit! The silence was the empty stage. I was off. Richard, who could only remember the next scene by who came on, had finally figured out that the absence of anyone entering at all must mean me, and calmly came to find me. Oops. The Leicester audience seemed to enjoy the empty stage as much as the play. I was not asked to stay on. Fortunately, Humphrey Barclay liked my radio scripts, and he wanted more. So I set off for London to see what the sixties were all about. Mainly, I suspected, other people having a far better time than me. In January 1966, I began life in London with a long-lasting case of mono, glandular fever, which left me debilitated but still able to write. I spent so much time in bed that I started the Mickey Baker complete course in jazz guitar, which taught me all the sneaky, funky chords I eventually used in Brightside. I liked all the diminished and major and minor sixths and sevenths. The chords I could read from the tablature, but I gave up when I got to the dots. Thanks to Humph, I was now a professional scriptwriter, as I'm Sorry I'll Read That Again paid me 3 guineas a minute for my material, and we would congregate on Sunday nights at the Playhouse, the BBC's radio comedy theatre, where the recordings took place before a large and wildly over-enthusiastic crowd, after which we'd all hang out with the cast at the Sherlock Holmes pub. There were occasional forays into acting. I was chosen by Ken Russell to play the death chauffeur in the BBC TV production of Isadora, accidentally drowning her children in the Seine in a tragic car accident, and then sitting on top of a hearse with Michael Palin and Terry Jones as a jazz band while she had sex inside with a wild Russian poet. I was co-opted to play a slow Loris in The Pool of Tears in Jonathan Miller's Alice in Wonderland, which enabled me to hang out with my heroes, Jonathan, Alan Bennett, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, as well as an incredible cast, including Peter Sellers, Wilfrid Lawson and Michael Redgrave. It was halfway through the 60s. The birth control pill had begun its work of female sexual liberation, and the party was definitely starting. Ah, the 60s. A beautiful blonde I was crazy about generously gave me hepatitis, wriggling around on a Naugahyde sofa. And a sweet hippie girl kindly shared a mild sexual disease, which sent me embarrassingly to a clinic. My relentless pursuit of women was perhaps understandable after being locked up for 12 years, but it meant that while I never got to understand the female outside of the bedroom, at least I was getting a fairly healthy introduction to her anatomy. I was well on my way to becoming the artful nudger.
Is your wife a goer? Not on me. Nudge, nudge. Not on me.
Chapter 6, The Artful Nudger. David Frost had plucked John Cleese from the shipwreck of the extremely funny Cambridge Circus Review, which had foundered on Broadway thanks to a panning in the New York Times. David, although a poor performer himself, was always at pains to surround himself with funny men, and he knew the value of having good material. His unexpected call to John Cleese in New York, asking him to be on the Frost Report, secured John's future in television, away from his mother's ambitions to make him manager of a Western supermarket, Marks and Spencer's. Grocery's loss was comedy's gain. Frosty gave all of us great jobs as writers on his new BBC TV show, for which we remained highly ungrateful. Suddenly, almost straight out of college, we were all part of a big hit. The Frost Report broadcast live once a week from the BBC television theatre in Shepherd's Bush. Its hilarious cast of Ronnie Barker, Ronnie Corbett, Sheila Stiefel and John Cleese performed sketches on a weekly theme, education, politics, art, linked by what David rather pretentiously called CDM, continually developing monologue, and which John and Graham contemptuously called Odgeril, old jokes and ridiculously irrelevant links. Amazingly, at 23, I was a writer on this very funny show. Where I had been paid 3 guineas a minute to write for BBC Radio, now I wrote gags and sketches for BBC TV at 10 guineas a minute. I had money in my pocket, a car, girls and an agent. Roger Hancock, brother of the legendary British comedian Tony Hancock, who gave me this invaluable advice. Be available. And so I was, for money, sex and show business. I lived in a top-floor flat in Notting Hill Gate and lunched at the Sun in Splendour in the Portobello Road, listening to customers at the bar quoting my jokes from last night's TV. I soon learned the comparative value of writing and writers. On the day of the show, a taxi came for my gags. I had to go by tube. When the Frost Report won the Golden Rose of Montreux, it was my karate joke they showed on BBC TV News. My cup ranneth over. David Frost now asked me, Graham Chapman and Barry Cryer to create a TV sitcom for Ronnie Corbett called No, That's Me Over Here. Graham had graduated from St. Bart's Hospital, and he now wrote professionally with John. They had recombined with Timbrook Taylor in an extremely funny late-night comedy show produced by David called At Last the 1948 Show, in which I would play small parts each week. John had asked for Marty Feldman to be in it, but David had balked about casting Marty. What about his looks? He asked. But John's will prevailed, and he was right. Marty was an instant star. After 2 short seasons of this brilliantly funny comedy, Marty went off to the BBC to do his own series. I love Marty. He and his wife, Loretta, took me under their wings and on Sundays to live recordings of Round the Horn, England's most popular radio series, which Marty wrote with Barry Took. I once found him and John Cleese in a street laughing their heads off. They'd just come across 2 very attractive young ladies bent over searching the pavement. What are you doing? They asked. We're looking for a screw, said one of the ladies. Collapse of hysterical comedians. Legendary television scriptwriter Barry Cryer had mentored me as a young writer, along with Dick Vosburgh on The Frost Report. He seemed to have an endless supply of gag books. Often, while Barry and I wrote for Ronnie Corbett, Graham would be absent writing the 48 show. One day we called and asked to speak to him because we had a plot problem we needed his thoughts on. But he's with you, said a puzzled Timbrook Taylor. No, he's with you. But, of course, he was with neither, having sneaked off to Hampstead, where he had a boyfriend hidden. He'd met David Sherlock in Ibiza, where he and John were writing a movie, and had fallen in love. Secretly moved into an apartment with him in Hampstead and concealed all this for a year. Finally, all was revealed at a coming-out party, where the first person I saw was Graham's female fiancée in tears. This is the man I'm in love with, said Graham, introducing David to me. Of course, now it all made sense. That's where he was. Unfortunately, Graham misread my thoughts for disapproval, and wrote later that I seemed not to know what a homosexual was. Hardly likely after 12 years of boarding school, 3 years of Cambridge, 6 months in rep, 2 years at the BBC, and currently living upstairs from Gay News in Redcliffe Square. I clearly remember my thoughts at the party. You bastard! You were up in Hampstead nobbing when you were supposed to be writing with us! Anyway, David Sherlock is a very nice man, and Graham lived happily with him for the rest of his life. Marty called us all next day and said, don't stop making the gay jokes. A few years later, I got this letter about Graham. Liverpool, Merseyside, 25/10/74, to Mr. E. Idle. Dear Sir, on the 18th of July, 1960, I was in St. Elizabeth's Church when our Lord Jesus Christ appeared to me. He showed me how he created us with the middle finger of his left hand. He pointed to a white cloud of dust. There was a man, he wouldn't give his name, but he said he was out of Monty Python's Flying Circus. He was being interviewed on the television and said he was a homosexual. In the Holy Bible, Leviticus, page 102, paragraph 20, verse 13, God says, "If a man lies with a male, as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination, they shall be put to death. Their blood is upon them." Praise be to thee, O Lord. God bless you, Mrs. B. Campbell. I wrote back to Mrs. B. Campbell, BBC TV Centre, Shepherd's Bush, London, 24/11/1974. "Dear Mrs. Campbell, thank you very much for your letter. We have found out who it was and have put him to death. Yours sincerely, Eric Idle." Another momentous phone call from Humphrey Barclay once again changed my life. Would I like to write and perform in a kids' sketch show on ITV? Hell yeah! I sensibly asked if I could have Michael Palin and Terry Jones. He agreed, they agreed, and suddenly we were starring in our own TV series with David Jason and Denise Coffey. Sure, it was only for kids, but we decided that we would not talk down to them. We would just do what we found funny. Humph brought in the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, an eccentric group of ex-art school students who performed downright weird songs, with Vivian Stanchel as lead singer and Neil Innes on piano. I'm sure Python gained a surreal boost from this encounter with the Bonzos, a bizarre Dadaist orchestra. For two whole seasons, we Oxbridge boys collided with the best of British art schools, as they came in weekly from the rigours of the road to commandeer the hairdryers in the makeup room. Their mad, whimsical, wonderful music meshed perfectly with our straight-faced determination not to talk down to our kids' audience. One day, a strange-looking American with long hair, who looked a bit like singer-songwriter John Denver, wearing a yakskin Afghan coat, came back after a show to meet us. It was love at first sight. I loved that coat. He brought an exotic girlfriend and some sketches, both written and drawn. He'd been sent to Humphrey Barclay by John Cleese, whom he'd met in New York, and he wanted to work on our show. Mike and Terry disliked him at once. What on earth did we need another writer for? And an American? Was I nuts? I don't know why, but I was convinced he had something, and it wasn't just his exotic coat. Luckily, they listened to me, and Terry Gilliam entered our lives, soon finding his métier making short animations, including the magnificent Christmas cards and a weirder one called Elephants, whose stream of consciousness flow would eventually form the basis for Monty Python. Do Not Adjust Your Set was a big hit from the start. We began on the Rediffusion channel in black and white, winning the Prix Jeunesse in Munich, and when that company lost its license, we were picked up by its successor, Thames Television, for a second series, this time in colour. Our time slot of 5:25 meant that not only did we get kids, we got all the waiters in London, and a decent proportion of adults coming home from work early. Two of those who always stopped work to watch were John Cleese and Graham Chapman. They thought it was the funniest thing on television. One day in 1969, they called and asked if we'd like to join them in a show for the BBC to provide quirky, alternative viewing for late-night Sunday audiences after the pubs closed. By then, we had a serious offer for our own 90-minute grown-up primetime show on ITV. But unfortunately, we had to wait 18 months for a studio. So we decided we might as well fit in the BBC thing with John and Graham while we were waiting for our big break. So began Monty Python. Chapter 7, and now for something slightly completely different. So much has been written about Monty Python. There have been memoirs, diaries, books about the Pythons, books by the Pythons about the other Pythons, articles about the books about the Pythons, countless interviews, autobiographies, documentaries. So many documentaries. I honestly think there are more hours of documentary about Python than there are hours of Python. So to the mass of mangled memories, do I now add my own muddled, prejudiced, and deeply cynical account of what I think might have happened? Of course. But you, dear reader, who have already parted with far too much money on this book, can feel free to skip ahead to the dirty bits. Well, fat chance, there aren't any. George Harrison once said to me, if we'd known we were going to be the Beatles, we would have tried harder. I think the same could be said of Monty Python. How on earth could we possibly know we would become them? At the time, we were only doing another show, and a fill-in show at that, while we waited for our big break on ITV. Who decides these things? The gods of television, or a little old lady in a cottage near Luton? Well, obviously the latter, but she's very hard to find. Why was Monty Python so successful? Was it really so very different? Of course it wasn't. People seem to think that it somehow sprang full-blown from the head of some mad media Medusa. But that's not true at all. In the mid-60s, there were a host of similar shows all evolving, banging into each other and disintegrating. The Frost Report, I'm sorry I'll read that again, Twice a Fortnight, Broaden Your Mind, How to Irritate People, The Complete and Utter History of Britain. All of the eventual Pythons were involved with all of the eventual goodies in one show or another. Monty Python itself was the result of a collision between Do Not Adjust Your Set and at last the 1948 show, when the creators of the former, me, Mike Palin, Terry Jones and Terry Gilliam, rammed into the remnants of the latter, John Cleese and Graham Chapman. So, of all the TV shows on air at the end of the 60s, what made Python so successful? Well, we were young, we were ready, we'd done Malcolm Gladwell's recommended 10,000 hours of preparation, see Outliers, we were digital, and we were in colour, only by a few months, but that was vitally important. Python began right at the start of the digital era, which meant that 50 years later, the show physically still doesn't look as dated as it would had it been shot in black and white and on film. Thanks to new technology, we can polish the dots so that visually the show looks even fresher today than it did when it was first transmitted back in the Stone Age. Additionally, we were both the writers and the performers, though the writers were definitely in charge. Importantly, the show is encyclopedic. Python isn't just one type of humour, it is a compendium of styles. While the cast remains the same, the writers are constantly changing, though you never notice which hand is on the tiller. So there is visual humour, verbal humour, clever humour, silliness, rudeness, sophistication and brazen naughtiness, constantly alternating, which means there's something for everyone. I found that while people said they liked it, not everyone could agree on which particular bits they liked. Also, we were at the BBC, who opened up a new time slot for us late on Sunday nights, when the Queen normally came on screen sitting on a horse and television closed down. They didn't know it, but there were a whole lot of people who liked to stay up after the pubs closed. I often joke about executive-free comedy, but the BBC really did leave us alone, especially at the beginning. And by the time they wanted to intrude, it was too late. Plus, we could be physically daunting. Six large men, 3 over 6 foot, occupying a BBC office, were enough to intimidate the bravest programme planner, even if we hadn't already established on our show that we considered them foolish, ignorant, hopeless idiots without degrees. The fact is, we scared them. We didn't know what we were doing and insisted on doing it. The legendary Chaotic Python first meeting with Michael Mills, the head of Light Entertainment, did take place at the BBC on May 23, 1969. We had met previously at John's apartment in Battle Street, so we were not entirely unprepared, but we'd reached no agreement on anything. That state would persist till the end. We couldn't agree on the title of the show, we didn't know whether there would be music, perhaps, or guests, maybe, or film. Oh, yes, film, good idea. In the end, faced with our confident uncertainty about what might be in our show, Michael Mills finally said, oh, just go away and make 13. We could do what we liked, but what would it be? Even we had no idea. On Do Not Adjust Your Set, Terry Gilliam had created highly surreal animations in a free-flowing style that inspired Terry Jones to proclaim that this was how our new BBC show should be. These arresting animations bookmarked the Python show and added a stylish Victorian framework that provided apparent connections between completely disparate sketch material. No punchlines, everything would just flow. This, and our attempts to link skits by ideas, theme and content, made Monty Python something slightly completely different from the start. Even though we didn't know what we wanted, we knew absolutely what we didn't want. We were determined not to make the usual kind of BBC light entertainment show where someone said, "And now for something completely different," and some prick sang. In fact, so determined were we not to do that, we co-opted their very slogan and used it as a catchphrase. We were the antithesis of the satire boom of the previous generation. Nothing was topical, so it could last, and the comedy was generic, types, not individuals. But it was our attitude that came across. Python was in your face, challenging, and very silly. It was not immediately popular. There were complaints, the executives hated it, but it filled a hole in their schedule, and the BBC wisely ignored the disapproval. So, owl stretching time began. So, a horse, a spoon, and a basin started. So, Wither Canada commenced. So, the toad elevating moment came into being. So, You Can't Call a Show Cornflakes appeared. We still had no title for the show. The BBC were going nuts. In their contracts, they called it Barry Took's Flying Circus, because he had set up the fatal meeting. But each of our scripts that came in had a different and, to their minds, worst title. Finally, in late July, with the series already filming, they presented us with an ultimatum. They had to print tickets for the audience. They must have a title. We all liked Flying Circus, but we couldn't agree on whose circus it should be. Michael wanted to surprise a little old lady in Suffolk called Gwen Dibley by naming the show after her. But while that was funny, there were legal issues. In the end, John suggested Python, and I suggested Monty after a chap with a moustache and bow tie in my local pub, the Dog Inn, Mapplebury Green. Monty had echoes of the great British General Montgomery, who at El Alamein was the first to defeat the Nazis, as well as sounding like a sleazy Soho theatrical agent. So Monty Python it was. But what was the show to be? We still hadn't a clue. We tried discussing what it should be about, but failed hopelessly. So we just went ahead and wrote what we felt like, and then got together at Jonesy's house in Camberwell and read out our sketches. If we laughed, it was in, and if we didn't, we sold it to the two Ronnies. Fortunately, I'd written one sketch for Ronnie Barker that had been turned down. If you read it silently, it obviously has no jokes. Is your wife a goer? Know what I mean? Nudge, nudge. Say no more, say no more, say no more. Know what I mean? Nudge, nudge. Where's the comedy in that? But when I read it aloud, in character, is your wife a goer? Not on me. Nudge, nudge. Say no more, say no more. Not on me. Nudge, nudge. They all hooted, and it was almost the first thing accepted by us. We became fairly good at editing our material. That sketch was really funny until page 3, and then it just went on and on. Honesty from people you trust is very useful, and often we would swap sketches around and let someone else have a go at finishing a piece. When it came to voting, I was always outnumbered. Mike and Terry were a team, and John and Graham another. And when they read out their sketches, they always had a partner to smile and laugh along. I face 5 people, but then on the other hand, I'm still with me. Terry Gilliam came in and out of the writing sessions and was a very useful, free-floating radical. Early on, we stopped him reading out his cartoon ideas, which consisted of a lot of bangs and booms and biffs, and told him to just go away and make them. We never cast the shows until we'd finished the writing, so we could not be influenced by any acting preferences. It was usually obvious who would play what, and the authors of the piece would get first dibs. John and Graham had settled into a kind of classic sketch form begun in the Frost Report, where John would be the aggressive protagonist, responding to interruptions from a very silly man. Marty played these roles in the 48 show, but in Python, Michael made a superb foil for him. Graham played authoritarian but hopelessly weak figures, responding helplessly to exterior chaotic forces, colonels, King Arthur, Brian, etc. Terry Jones specialised in aggressively noisy, frumpy women, and Terry Gilliam was given anything that involved long and heavy makeup, so it was no surprise when he married Maggie Weston, a makeup lady. The rest of the characters, often a whole raft of them, were designated Mike or Eric, and then the authorship would decide who played what. Nudge for Eric, Ken Shabby for Mike. Significantly, Monty Python was not released in America until 1974, after we had finished on UK TV. So we were not seduced by personal fame. We didn't have to cope with the hot blast of instant celebrity that the Saturday Night Live cast faced. With the exception of John Cleese, who was famous from the Frost Report, no one had a clue who was who. Looking back, it is amazing that John even wanted to be in another gang show, his fourth since leaving Cambridge. I'm sorry, I'll read that again. The Frost Report, The 48 Show, and now Monty Python. In fact, he soon tired of Python, and no wonder. He'd been writing and performing sketches on TV and radio since 1965. In the meantime, I got married. I'd fallen in love with a beautiful Australian actress called Lynn Ashley, whose painted breasts I first saw on a poster outside my local cinema advertising the Michael Winner film I'll Never Forget What's His Name, in which she starred with Oliver Reed. Some friends had set us up on a blind date for a weekend in a wincingly cold Elizabethan mansion in Suffolk. The wind howled through it. The kitchen, with its Argus stove, seemed to be the only warm spot, and the house was infested by kids. We found the hostess was fighting with her husband, had taken to her bed and refused to emerge from her bedroom. I enticed her out with a bottle of champagne. Some kind of order was restored. Lynn and I found a warm spot in the guest wing and became acquainted, while I fought off the blocking moves of her mother's poodle. We soon moved into my apartment in Redcliffe Square, flew off to Mijas in Spain where I bought a ring, and one year later, in July 1969, when Monty Python commenced filming, I managed to wangle the first week off to get married. We were married in the Kensington and Chelsea Registry Office, and my new mother-in-law, Madge Ryan, threw a huge party at Adrian Corrie's house in St. John's Wood. Both actresses had appeared together in Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange. Then off we all went to the seaside. The Pythons to Devon, me to Nice. While the others took the bus to Torquay, I flew with my new bride to Cap d'Antibes, where Loretta and Marty Feldman had invited us to join them. Monty Python's Flying Circus began broadcasting on BBC One at 10:55 p.m. on Sunday, October the 5th, 1969, with the second show we had recorded, subtitled With a Canada. The original audience consisted largely of little old ladies who had been bussed into the BBC Television Centre, thinking they were going to see some kind of a circus. Neither they nor we had a clue what they were in for. While there were some very funny sketches, there were also some very odd moments, like Terry Gilliam popping up in the middle of a sketch, dressed as a Viking, with a ferret through his head, saying, "However." I think these were attempts by us to flex our muscles and experience the joys of this newfound freedom. We did them because we could. As if to keep us in our place, the BBC would unexpectedly take our show off the air from time to time and replace it with an episode of the Horse of the Year show. Occasionally, different BBC regions put out their own local show instead. This led to some confusion amongst our audience, a confusion we were keen to exploit. We began to shoot false openings. In one case, 10 minutes of a totally fictitious pirate film before the Buccaneers passed John Cleese at a table, who announced blandly, "And now for something completely different." It didn't matter. No one was watching. We could do it to make ourselves happy. This sense of being apart in a different TV world from the comforting domain of light entertainment was very liberating, and oddly, we began to attract a following. After the first season, the BBC made us do a record, which was a disaster, since they recorded it in front of a dead audience live on a Sunday morning in Camden Town Hall. None of us liked it, after which we simply made our own albums. The finest example of this was a three-sided record, the Monty Python Matching Tie and Handkerchief, where we ingeniously cut double grooves on side two to create two shorter parallel sides. Which track played depended on where the needle dropped. There was no announcement or warning. To further puzzle listeners, we started both of these mini-sides with the same bad gag. And now a massage from the Swedish Prime Minister. So they couldn't even try to find the side they wanted. Confusion was good. We were still outsiders and rebellious. We took exception to BBC Light Entertainment inviting us to their Christmas party because the invitation said black tie. The first year we simply didn't attend, but the second year John Cleese and I determined to make a protest. We decided to go overdressed. We turned up at the BBC in top hats, white tie and tails, complete with gloves and canes. Our arrival at the party caused quite a stir. Eric Morecambe came over to me and said, "John Cleese just bit me on the neck and flew out the window." We all agreed that our show would never play in America. They just wouldn't understand it. And besides, with its nudity and its naughtiness, it would never be allowed on TV there. So when some serious American producers approached us, we laughed. It appeared they wanted us to make our show for America. We laughed more. All right then, could they buy our format? Now we really laughed. We don't have a format. Then let's not sell it to them. We laughed even harder. John's friend Victor Lowndes, who ran the London Playboy Club, commissioned a movie from us of highlights from the first two seasons because he felt there was an audience for Python in colleges and it should be a film. We shot, and now for something completely different, in an old dairy in Hendon for £80,000. Our TV director, the Wild Scotsman Ian McNaughton, was appointed director. Ian had begun as an actor but had joined the BBC, where he became involved directing shows with Spike Milligan. This is what attracted him to us. He wasn't available for our first four TV recordings, and John Howard Davis had stepped in. As a young boy, Davis had played Oliver in David Lean's classic movie, Oliver Twist. "Please, sir, I want some more." He would go on to direct Fawlty Towers for John Cleese, and Ian directed all our subsequent Python shows. It was Davis who brought Carol Cleveland into our show when we needed a real woman to play the sex scene in my marriage guidance counsellor sketch. The gag just didn't work with a guy in drag, and Carol would remain a fixture whenever we wanted a real female. She was a jolly good sport and came on the road with us on our tours. And now for something completely different was the first of the movies she did for us. McNaughty, as we called him, was definitely a Scottish loony, with a penchant for whiskey. John pilloried him mercilessly as a drunken director in Scott of the Sahara, and then claimed it wasn't him at all, but Joseph McGrath, another hard-drinking Scots director. Ian would be fine until lunchtime, when he could never resist going into the pub, and then would have to go and lie down afterwards, so usually one of the Terrys took over. We weren't in charge of the final cut, none of us liked it, and it was memorable only for a controversy about a fart, when the American producer said, "Keep the fart, you'll lose Disneyland." We kept the fart. Columbia ended up releasing the movie, and eventually Victor Lowndes' boss, Hugh Hefner, bought it. So it had its uses, getting us into the Playboy Mansion in the 80s, when that seemed like a good idea. In 1971, we tackled the publishing world when I took on the editing of Monty Python's Big Red Book, which naturally was blue, and then the brand new Monty Python Papabok, 1973, whose cover deliberately contained grubby finger marks, so that people kept returning them to the booksellers. Terry Gilliam refused to have anything to do with the first book, snorting disdainfully, "Comic books don't sell." I suppose his experiences with Harvey Kurtzman's Health magazine in New York, where he drew cartoons and shot fumetti, had clouded his judgment. His assistant, Katie Hepburn, was helping me design the book, and I had to get her to break into his studio and steal bits of his artwork. Fortunately, Terry was wrong, as that first Python book flew off the shelves into massive reprints, inventing the Christmas comedy book market. Books, records, films, TV shows, slowly the Python tentacles wound around the neck of an unsuspecting public. I persuaded the Pythons to do a live stage show for 3 nights at midnight at the Lanchester Arts Festival in Coventry, selecting the sketches and putting together a show that we briefly rehearsed. The audiences went nuts. I think it was the first time they found that other people liked our show too. The BBC didn't pay us much, but after Coventry, Tony Smith and Harvey Goldsmith offered us a ton of money to tour the UK. So we set off on the road. It was a fairly disastrous start, thanks to a stoner sound engineer who was in charge of our radio mics. He hadn't a clue which of us was which, so you could clearly hear Graham in his dressing room, but nobody on stage at all. We finally persuaded the management to dispose of him before we were forced to kill him, and the show soon got into a groove. Graham's drinking, at first a secret, now came to the fore. Often he would be late on stage for his sketches, particularly with poor Mike waiting around to start Ken Shabby. Once John and I heard the ominous silence from the audience, and both leapt on stage at the same time from opposite sides. Then, as if we'd rehearsed it, we fell in behind each other and played Graham's part in tandem, to the hilarity of Mike, who giggled helplessly. Finally, Graham came lurching on as the colonel, seemed not to notice, and launched into the beginning of the sketch again. After the show, he was furious and accused me of upstaging him. "But Graham," I said, "you weren't on stage." He never said a word of complaint to John. The only time I ever saw him lose it was when John hid his pipe as a prank, and Graham went totally berserk. Yes, we know, Dr. Freud. He was a very mild and patient man, but the alcohol turned him into a beast. He would go crawling round the floor at parties, putting his hands up ladies' skirts and barking like a dog. It was great when he finally managed to conquer his alcoholism. John would occasionally bait Jonesy until he exploded in a fit of temper, but on the whole, we got on very well for a group of 6 outsiders. Just look at the work we managed to achieve in the 14 years between 1969 and 1983. 5 movies, 45 TV shows, 5 stage shows, 5 books and countless records, including a hit single. So, yes, we did okay, but fame still beckoned. Chapter 8. Wither, Canada. I remember quite clearly the moment I realised Monty Python had become famous. From the British tour, it was evident we had achieved celebrity, but by the Canadian tour, this fame had turned into fanaticism. I can pin this incident with precision to the June day in 1973 when we arrived at the Toronto airport for Monty Python's first farewell tour of Canada. As we came into the arrivals lobby, there was a tremendous scream. Instinctively, every one of us turned round and looked behind to see who was coming. Surely some famous rock group was arriving. Then came the dawning revelation. It was for us. There were screaming fans waiting at the airport. They held banners and signs and went totally crazy. We responded with surprise and a little embarrassment. Terry Gilliam reacted by lying down on the baggage carousel and riding around, to John's evident disgust. To be honest, we were not entirely sober. We had begun the flight quietly enough, scattered throughout the Air Canada first-class lounge. But when a stewardess asked if passenger Cohen would identify himself, Neil Innes began it. He rose to his feet and said, "I'm passenger Cohen." "No, I'm passenger Cohen," I said, raising my hand. "I'm passenger Cohen," said Gilliam, getting into the Spartacus gag. "No, I'm passenger Cohen," said Carol Cleveland. The stewardess was utterly bewildered as 8 different people insisted they were passenger Cohen from all over the first-class lounge. Then the bar opened. So suddenly we were face-to-face with Canadian adulation. The promoters stuck us on the upper level of an open-top double-decker bus, and we were followed into Toronto by cars honking and people yelling. The Canadians were nuts about Python. They'd been watching the TV show since very early on, and there had been mass protests outside CBC when they tried to take it off the air. These fans were crazy. "Shut up," John would yell crossly at the screaming audience as we appeared on stage. "We haven't done anything funny yet." But they only laughed more. They had come for a good time, and nothing would stop them. At one show in Winnipeg, the curtain rose to reveal the entire front row dressed as a caterpillar. You can't really fail with an audience like that. Graham went off happily visiting bars recommended to him by his useful gay guide to Canada, suffering only on Sundays, when he legally couldn't get a drink anywhere except in his hotel room, and then only with food. Nancy Lewis, a U.S. record executive and our number one supporter in the early days, remembers visiting him and finding piles and piles of untouched Caesar salads outside his door that he had ordered with each round. Tony Smith, our promoter, had never been to Canada and had no idea of the huge distances between cities, so it was essentially a dartboard tour, where we ping-pong back and forth across the lakes and plains. To make matters worse, Air Canada was on strike, and after the first show in Toronto, we never saw our set again. We were always one gig ahead. Fortunately, we had the movie reel and the costumes with us, so we needed to find only tables and chairs and a dead duck wherever we went, for a gross sketch about cocktails. Twist of lemming, sir? We joyfully sang the lumberjack song, dressed as Mounties, in Regina, the home of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Of course, Graham found a gay Mountie afterwards. That's rather the point of the song. We all reacted differently to this newfound fame. John decided to leave. In my case, fame went to my balls. It would have been impossible not to have been affected in some way, especially when we went on down to California, where the 60s were still raging. The North American female proved to be very grateful. The Canadian boys assumed that we were all on drugs and thoughtfully supplied them. I was an English boarding school boy let loose in a candy store. Was I becoming an asshole? I'm afraid so. Back home, I had a lovely wife and a newborn baby. What was I thinking? Clearly, I wasn't. Men have a brain and a penis, and only enough blood to supply one at a time. The fact is, until quite late in life, men think with their dicks. It's a pity, it's regrettable, it's unfortunate, and I say this with no pride, but it's true. The inevitable fall lay ahead. The BBC had offered us a fourth season, and John was definitely not keen on the idea. For him, the Canadian tour was the tipping point. He hated it. He took to dining alone at a table in the same restaurant as the rest of us, reading a book and pointedly ignoring us as we got rowdier and rowdier. He had some silly idea for a sitcom he wanted to do about an angry hotelier set in a British holiday hotel in Torquay. Well, good luck with that. He decided to turn down another Python series. Graham broke the news on the flight to our final gig in Vancouver. To those of us who were enjoying the newfound adulation, John's decision seemed crazy. To Graham, who needed the money, it was disastrous. He persuaded us to do a fourth season without John. Meanwhile, California lay ahead. Nancy Lewis had told L.A. record executive Neil Bogart that we were the next big thing, and persuaded Buddha Records to put out a Monty Python album. They flew us down to San Francisco to promote it, and then on to L.A., where we checked into the legendary Hyatt House on the Sunset Strip. This Hyatt House hotel had earned its sobriquet from the destruction wrought in it by visiting English rock stars such as Keith Moon, who threw television sets out of its windows and drove cars into its pool. We were soon leading lives of careless abandon in the California sunshine. Graham legendarily took a limo to a restaurant just across the street. He hadn't realized it was that close. The rest of us enjoyed our first taste of America. Our promotional appearances were mainly on radio, where we tried to explain to puzzled DJs that we were not a circus. And this culminated in a big television appearance on The Tonight Show, though sadly without Johnny Carson. David Brenner was sitting in for him. He gave us a heartwarming intro. "I've never heard of these guys. People say they're funny. Please welcome Monty Python." We were supposed to do half an hour of our best material. The curtain went up on Graham and Terry J, dressed as Pepper Potts, screeching in high-pitched British accents. We call these loud, over-made-up ladies Pepper Potts because of their physical resemblance to real Pepper Potts.
Oh, hello, dear. How are you? Ooh, I've been up all night burying the cat. Is it dead? No, but it's not at all a well cat, so I thought best to bury it to be on the safe side.
To say the response was underwhelming is an understatement. The audience stared at us open-mouthed. This very same material that had just carried us across Canada on gales of laughter was greeted with total silence. Two British men in drag screaming at each other about a dead cat? We were from another planet. It was short, it was fast, and it was fucking hilarious. We did the half hour of material in 20 minutes and then ran outside, where we collapsed on the grass, screaming with laughter. It was hysterical. I think it's one of the best laughs I've ever had. There's nothing funnier than nobody laughing. Terry Jones and I fared slightly better when we performed Nudge Nudge on a late-night music show, The Midnight Special, for George Slaughter and Ed Friendly, the producers of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. It repeated happily for many years, so the sketch became very well known in America. Elvis called everybody Squire because of it. Meanwhile, we spent our time at the Hollywood Bowl, where we saw Gladys Knight and the Pips, enjoyed Little Richard at the Rainbow Bar and Grill, and were up and down the strips like yo-yos. Well, more like dildos. At the time, people thought we only made records, like the Firesign Theatre. They had no idea that this material came from TV shows. To them, we were simply recording artists. On our return to London, the BBC were less than keen to find they'd lost John Cleese, and they punished us in typical BBC ways. We were relegated to BBC Two, and were not allowed to use the words Flying Circus in the title. For the fourth season, we will be known simply as Monty Python.
Oh, gee, we are so scared.
There were many funny things in those six shows. The Most Awful Family in Britain, Queen Victoria Handicap, Woody and Tinny Words, RAF Banter. But for me, something was missing. John, of course. Not his writing, because he did contribute a lot from all the material we'd cut from the Holy Grail. And even his performing was not so badly missed, as we had all learned a lot in three seasons. But importantly, the balance was lost. John had kept Terry J's explosive Welsh determination in check, and without him, that didn't happen. So when the BBC offered us a further seven shows, it was me, this time, who said no, on a long walk with Michael on Hampstead Heath. This turned out to be a good thing, for while John didn't want to do any more TV, he was keen to do movies, and all of us were soon happily engaged on writing a new movie, which we were determined we would control and direct. At the second writing stint for what became Monty Python and the Holy Grail, we decided it should be entirely about King Arthur and his knights, without any of the distracting modern stuff set in the Harrods toupee department, which we used in the fourth series. John also appeared on stage with us again in March 1973 at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane for 4 weeks, and this time it was impossible not to notice we had become quite a big deal. Almost every single British rock star filled the boxes, from David Bowie to Elton John to Mick Jagger. Some of these rock stars now generously stepped forward to fund our next movie, which we made on a tiny budget of £200,000. Filming for 5 weeks on location in Scotland. These original investors for the Holy Grail were Robert Plant and Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Tim Rice, Jethro Tull, Island Records, Chrysalis Records, Charisma Records, and Michael White. Bless them for it. They didn't want to interfere or control, they just wanted to help us make our movie. I think Tony Stratton Smith, Graham's great drinking pal and head of Charisma, our record label, was largely responsible for bringing them all in. He even had a horse named Monty Python. Carol Cleven wasn't available for Monty Python Live at Drury Lane, so my wife, Lynn Ashley, played her parts. Lynn had appeared in a few Python shows, including one of the two German shows we made. The Germans had come to us and said, "We are German, and we have no sense of humour, so we want you to come over to Germany and make a Python comedy special for Bavaria TV." The clincher was they wanted us to come over for a writing recce, so they could show us some of the places we could write sketches for. Nobody had ever heard of a writer's recce, and it seemed like a free piss-up to us, so we flew to Munich and were met at the airport by a Bavarian band, huge steins of beer, and a big sign saying, "Welcome, Pythons!" Then they put us in cars and took us to Dachau. What the hell was this? On our way, we got lost, and passerbys denied all knowledge of the location of the camp. We finally arrived as it was getting dark, and they said it was closing. "Tell them we're Jewish," said Graham. Probably his finest moment. Anyway, they let us in, but luckily they let us out again. We puzzled over why they had taken us there. Surely they didn't expect us to write sketches set there. Were we supposed to be filming dancing in Dachau? The grim reality of the camp precluded all humour. In the end, we decided they probably just wanted to get the worst over with. And after that, things lightened up. Our hosts took us to Salzburg in Austria and to Mad King Ludwig's extraordinary Neuschwanstein Castle in Bavaria, where we would film for both shows, once at night with the wolves howling. The first show we made entirely in German. We wrote the script in English, they translated it into German, and we painstakingly learned the words parrot fashion. It meant we did a lot of visual humour, including silly Olympics and philosopher's football, filmed on the old Bayern Munich ground. We were billeted in a small but friendly guest house, where the proprietress was shocked one morning when Graham appeared at breakfast with four young men. She told him, with some embarrassment, that there was a special hotel down the street for your kind, where he would be made welcome, and he moved in there and had a delightful time. It was Oktoberfest, and we completely lost Graham for a couple of days of filming, because he was having so much fun. When he resurfaced, he flew back to London to accept a Sun Award on behalf of Monty Python. He took the statuette from the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Reginald Maudling, put it in his mouth, dropped to his knees, and then crawled off the stage through the audience, barking like a dog. It made the front page. One day, halfway up a mountain, John and I wrote a song called Eric the Half a Bee, while he was dressed as Little Red Riding Hood. Still my favourite performance of his. We had finished shooting a Fliegendes Zirkus scene and broken for lunch at a typical Bavarian cuckoo clock restaurant. John wandered into the gents, dressed in his full dirndl and skirt, to the shock of a stout German burger in Lederhosen. Since it was cold in the Alps, we ordered a delicious bottle of schnapps, and so we were not entirely sober, as I pulled out my guitar and we wrote a very silly song. Half a bee, philosophically, must ipso facto half not be. But half a bee is not a bee vis-à-vis its entity, you see? But can a bee be said to be, or not to be, an entire bee, when half the bee is not a bee, due to some ancient injury? Singing. La-dee-dee, 1, 2, 3, Eric the half a bee. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, Eric the half a bee. Is this wretched demi-bee half asleep upon my knee? Some freak from a menagerie. No, it's Eric the half a bee. The rest of the crew moved off to film Michael playing Buzz Aldrin. We finished the bottle. It was a delightful afternoon. What the Germans made of our speaking German on the TV show, I have no idea. But they invited us back, and this time, instead of painstakingly learning the German words,
"Er kann auf dieser Weise eine billigen Lacher bekommen,"
we sensibly spoke English, and they dubbed us. Terry Jones also had his finest moment in Munich. He and I had flown there one cold February to set up the second show. It was carnival at the time, and Münchners celebrate this with a festival called the Nockerberg, where they brew Starkbier, a special black beer so strong they close the beer cellars at 10 to stop them killing each other. The feast has been held since 1891 in a vast hall, the Paulaner, where everyone sits on benches at long tables. It was so big that there were two German bands, one at each end. The one on the main stage was conducted by a man with a metal claw instead of a hand. For 10 marks, anyone could come on stage to borrow the baton and conduct the Umpapa band. In one corner near the stage, I was shocked to see a table of older men wearing Nazi insignia. The evening progressed with beer and sausages, and after a couple of hours, my attention was drawn to the sight of Terry Jones appearing on stage. He took the baton from the claw of the conductor and advanced on the audience. He had a glint in his eyes I recognized. Oh, no. He began performing a striptease, flapping his jacket back and forth across his body like a stripper, then provocatively removing it and twirling it above his head before flinging it away. He removed his tie, salaciously rubbing it between his legs, before chucking it tantalizingly into the audience. People in the hall were beginning to notice what was going on, half fascinated, half horrified. He began unbuttoning his shirt, bumping and grinding to the beat of the band, and then turning around, he slowly removed it. He spun back round, arms high, revealing his naked chest, demanding applause, and then put his tongue out and began playing with his nipples. He moved inevitably to his trousers. Shit, he's going to take his pants off, I thought. We're going to get killed. Slowly, and to some encouragement, he removed his belt and then began to slide down his zipper. He'd undone his trousers and begun to slip his pants down when the irate conductor raced onto the stage, grabbed him, and physically dragged him off stage. "We have to go," I said to our host. "Get the car." I raced to the side of the stage and managed to hustle Terry out of the hall away from the Nazi table, who were indignantly watching this English boy. Somehow we managed to escape unharmed. It was the bravest and maddest thing I ever saw him do. Chapter 9, Here Comes the Sun. The birth of my son in 1973 was the most emotional experience of my life so far. We called him Carey, after Carey Harrison, my friend from Cambridge, with whom I'd first travelled to France. And as I drove away from the hospital, the Joni Mitchell song came on the radio. I burst into tears. It wasn't a normal birth. For a start, I was holding the lights. A gynaecologist was filming. Our son was born on camera. Because Lynn was an actress, her obstetrician had asked to film the birth, and Lynn had gamely agreed. We'd done some preliminary shots as her pregnancy advanced, where I played the rather unrewarding role of husband. Now the hospital room was a damn movie set. What were we thinking? In the end, we threw them out. A year later, in April 1974, with a one-year-old Carey, Lynn was back on the boards. Drury Lane was a sellout, and we extended the run from 2 to 4 weeks due to popular demand. Once again, the great and the good, the young and the lovely, the rock and the roll flocked to our show. We couldn't extend any longer, as we were due in Scotland for the soggy filming of the Holy Grail. Just before we left, the Department of the Environment for Scotland unexpectedly denied us permission to film in any of their castles, calling the film script incompatible with the dignity of the fabric of the buildings. Here, where thousands of Scotsmen had slit each other's throats, we were not to talk about the curtains. It was a disaster. The Terrys had scouted and prepped several castles, and now we were left with just two in private hands. Doune Castle, which suddenly starred in the movie as we shot it from every possible angle, and Castle Stalker. What had started as an underprepared and underfunded movie soon turned into full-blown chaos. The poor Terrys. We'd given them both the job of directing, which was smart for us and hell for them. In the end, one of them would edit by day, while the other would change everything by night. Our producer was soon disliked by both directors. His qualifications for the job seemed to be that he had once shared rooms with Terry Gilliam. John detested him, and even Michael was rude about him in his diary. Later, he would sue us for money from Spamalot. Of course, we had broken the Mike Nichols golden rule of production. No assholes. Fortunately, Michael White had supplied John Goldstone, a young, brilliant, bearded Mancunian, to look after his